Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome Stephen Downs. Yes, this is Stephen, the man behind Old Daily. He's here at last. Look, Stephen, welcome to education.au. As I said, this is actually a group of staff from the company here in Adelaide, and we were expecting Kath Parker, who is from Hobart, but unfortunately she's fogged in, so she's going to attend a later session. Stephen, I'm really pleased to have you here today, largely because I guess in many senses what we think we're trying to do sort of aligns very much with the work that you are doing as well, and that is about connecting people, but also about sharing and disseminating knowledge about the future of learning. And so that's why I decided the title today would be The Future of Online Learning and Knowledge Networks, because it has those two aspects, the learning aspect but also connecting people. So Stephen, welcome, and look forward to hearing from you. I also want to challenge the group today. Stephen can be controversial. In fact, I hope he will be controversial, and I want you to be able to challenge him. So we're going to allow 15 minutes at the end for some good questions. So be prepared, and I want you to challenge Stephen. Okay? So there's an opportunity for you. Okay, Stephen, thank you. Okay,
thank you very much. And just so you know, I am recording this session, as I have been recording the talks that I've been doing throughout Australia. So anything you say can and will be posted on my website. If I look a little fidgety, it's because this is the first time I've worn this shirt. I got this shirt specifically for Australia, but I've been in Cairns and Darwin and Alice Springs, and a heavy blue shirt wasn't really appropriate, but it's not, just a little fidgety. I'm doing this talk twice in a row, which is interesting because I've hardly ever done talks twice in a row. It won't be the same talk both times. It'll be the same slides. It'll be very different talks. I want to say I'm very pleased to be here. Many of you I've talked with online and collaborated with in one way or another over the years. The stuff that comes out of this building, as you know, finds its way to the pages of my newsletter frequently. And if you don't know, you should know that the work that you're doing here, from where I sit, has implications around the world. You're very much setting the pace in many areas and an example for a lot of people. That doesn't mean I agree with everything you do. there's utterly no question in my mind that what you do extremely well. And some of the world's leading expertise in our field is in this building, and probably in this room. Frightens me. because as you know, I have my thoughts. Let me ask just to begin, how many of you do read my newsletter? Okay, so more than half. This building. how many of you go to my website and read it when the email service here bounces it? Nobody? I get bounced quite a bit. So if you notice days missing in your newsletter, it's just as likely because the mail filters here at Education.au bounced it. Because it does come out very regularly, probably more regularly than you're reading it. So I just thought I'd mention that. So if on Sunday it doesn't show up, do go to my website. You may find a word that somebody doesn't want you to see or something like that, but it will be there. The topic I was given, and I was very foolish, I asked people to give me topics rather than saying what I would just talk about, although it's created some interesting scenarios in my talks. In Canberra, I talked about the new learner, and what was the other thing? I've forgotten it already. the new learner and quality in e-learning. And had to merge those two topics because I just let them pick the topics, and that's what they pick. So that resulted in some very interesting talks. And what we've got today is the future of online learning and knowledge networks. And of course, the assumption implicit in the title is that the future of online learning has something to do with knowledge networks, which is the sort of thing that's open for question. We need to question it because we're not always clear about these things. I think the future of online learning does have to do with knowledge networks. So this works out very fortuitously for me, because otherwise I'd really be trying to wing it. But networks, the concept of networks isn't a single concept. There are different ways of looking at networks, different approaches to networks. So overall, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be looking at what has come to be, if you will, the received view of learning resource networks or knowledge networks, and talk of... Oh, brought one for me too. Sure, I'll stop.
What's your order in?
I'm going to sit here and pout now. different ways of looking at networks, different ways of organizing knowledge networks, resource networks, and so I'm going to be looking at how my approach contrasts with that received view. So I'm going to begin by, slamming the received view. And there will be your controversy. But, David Wiley says, I just oppose everything. But it's not true. I oppose lots of things, but I do have an alternative picture, and I think that the alternative picture is more compelling, more sustainable, and in the end will be the future of online learning. I have many reasons for thinking that. Now, as with anything I say, I could be wrong, and hopefully I'll certainly be challenged. As you know, I've been in this for quite a while and worked a lot, not just in online learning, but in online content generally. And so I do think that there are good grounds for the things that I will say today, and I'll draw out some of those grounds. Preliminaries, this talk is for you, which means if you want to interrupt me, ask a question, make a comment, shout me down, that's not only your rights, but your responsibility. I like this to be interactive, because that's where the really neat content comes from, is when people pose questions and challenge the things that I have to say. So do please feel free to start a dialogue on whatever topic you think is appropriate. If the direction of this talk isn't suitable to you, I will change it, and we'll move off in a different direction. I have slides. I have a plan. I will freely abandon those slides and that plan at any point in this talk, depending on the wisdom of the room. So that's the preliminary. How does that sound so far? Nods and even some murmurs. I got murmurs. Why don't I move my
pretty good eyes
in front of the screen here? I don't usually get murmurs, so I'm way ahead of the game here. Rumbles and disruptions sort of rang me out of Canberra. No, I'm just kidding. Alright, this is...
I need to use the keyboard actually.
Yeah. Which one is... I never use the keyboard for PowerPoint. Which one advances the slides? All right.
Do you want me to do it?
Blue screen of death and thoughts.
Well, we can talk about the blue screen of death and why it's symptomatic of a dysfunctional design methodology of software, but I won't. The emerging consensus, and you guys had this just absolutely outstanding conference here recently that I covered in my newsletter. And I covered it extensively in my newsletter and described it as the state of the art. And I wish I had been here, but I couldn't be here because, I'm here now. And I can only get away with so many trips to Australia, am I? The emerging consensus is the consensus that's coming out of bodies like IMS, coming out of organizations like ADL in the United States, coming out of EDNA to a certain degree, coming out of Industry Canada, and other organizations, Merlot. The centerpiece, if you will, is the learning object. And there has been much discussion, even recently on my site, about what a learning object is. And the standard picture of a learning object is that it's a digital resource used to support learning. But what that means is that a learning object has to have a certain structure, a certain organization, has to be organized with pedagogical principles in mind. Typically, it would have learning objectives, so on and so forth. It would be not simply a single standalone resource, but something actually pulled together and organized in a pedagogically sound way. This is not my view of learning objects. In my view of learning objects, the learning is not in the object itself, but rather in how the object is used. We'll come back to that point. The emerging consensus, learning object metadata. The IMS specification, which of course is morphed into the IEEE learning object metadata, which is kind of locked down now, signed, sealed, delivered, backed, history. And then the various profiles that have spun off IEEE LOM, such as SCORM, the shareable content or shareable courseware object reference model. Dan Rehack was talking about how great it was that he actually changed that acronym. Sort of sitting there thinking, Dan, that wasn't a good thing, because now nobody knows. CanCore in Canada, of course, is now a spin-off from IEEE LOM. It's an application profile, an interpretation of the metadata standard for use in a particular domain or a particular application. IMS has numerous standards and specifications that it describes on its site. The Digital Repositories Initiative, which now an academic or advanced distributed learning is becoming something called CORDRA. I won't even try to remember what that stands for, but if you search for CORDRA on Google, you'll find it. It's probably the only thing out there named that. Which is basically the mechanism for access to learning objects and repositories, the mechanisms for search, retrieval. CORDRA is a whole entity unto itself, but I won't talk about in detail in this talk. But some of the questions that I raise in this talk, you should also pose to that particular specification. Learning design is another major IMS protocol whereby we use an XML file to organize and coordinate the display of learning resources for a learner. Learning design is based on the analogy of a play, as in theater, where the student plays a role and is stepped through the learning process by the algorithms specified in the learning design file. From where I sit, it's a very scripted model of e-learning. To play with the analogy of a play, if learning design supports plays, and it does that, it does not, by contrast, support improv. And my thinking is the future of learning is in improv, not scripted plays. Other stuff, enterprise architecture, the large suite of software tools today covered under the rubric of learning management systems, learning content management systems, student information systems, and so on. The common services that support such things, and these were described in some of the papers at the conference recently here. Federated search, the networks of repositories, with a system that allows a searcher to enter in a single search term, and that search term is, if you will, propagated so that a search is conducted on a large number of repositories all at once. These are the sorts of things that are emerging as the common consensus, that the architecture that a lot of the organizations, including to a significant degree this one, are behind. A lot of that, if not all of that, is based on Java technology, and especially J2EE. A lot of that, if not all of that, probably not quite all of that, but almost all of that, is based on the idea of web services. There is as well, partly because of the desires of the government who are funding these things, partly because of the desires of the partnerships and the membership of the various consortia. Here I'm thinking of things, for example, like EDUCAUSE and so on. A commercial orientation, the idea that we're not simply creating a place where learning materials are available for students, but also a place where producers or publishers of learning materials can gain access to a marketplace to sell their resources. Hence, we see a significant emphasis on things like digital rights management, and there's been a lot of talk about digital rights management. And again, there isn't as much of a consensus in this area, but there's sort of a consensus that learning resources ought to have rights expressions attached to them, that these rights expressions ought to be in some way enforceable, and therefore that the distribution network, however it is constructed, would require the mechanisms of a DRM system, including user authentication, and therefore federated authentication, single sign-on, and those sorts of things, in order to make sure that the wrong person doesn't view the wrong resource. That's the received view. Other people could describe that better than I've just done. It is being described in quite a bit of detail in numerous papers and descriptions, with many, if not most, of which I've carried on my own website. And it seems to be the way in which the world is heading. Next slide, please. They'll go faster. So there's an emerging consensus. Right, so.
Technical exercise.
All for one. All right. I think that there are significant underlying and fundamental problems with this consensus. And quite frankly, in terms of the organizations, and especially the people who sit on these standards bodies and all that, I'm almost alone in this thinking. I am not alone in this thinking, though. And the further away I get from these centers, the more, in my view, my thinking is resonating with the thinking of other people. So I don't feel like, you know, this lone voice in the wind. I feel something quite different. The concept of learning objects hasn't hit home. Especially the concept of learning objects as organized and delivered by things like learning management systems. We're beginning to see in various articles and on the discussion boards in that a groundswell of dissatisfaction with the learning object model, because the learning object model is, to a large degree, what we used to call page turners, and they're fancier page turners now, and they report student grades, but nonetheless they're still page turners, which means that the delivery of knowledge and resources is static, it's constrained. There is not the emphasis on interaction that a lot of people were looking for. Learning objects turn out to be difficult to be customized or modified by instructors. They turn out to be difficult to move from one learning management system to another learning management system. We have not achieved yet this objective of a common pool of learning objects or learning resources that can be shared and swapped and so on. That vision isn't there yet. It's getting closer, but the learning objects that we see are being constrained by the technology, both the technology used to create them and the technology being used to distribute them. There is, in addition, what David Wiley calls the reusability paradox, whereby the more precisely a learning object is attuned to an educational objective, the less shareable it is. And if you think about it, that makes sense. If you design an object with a specific educational object, it's not going to be very useful elsewhere. But if you define it so that it's useful in many places, then its educational objective is not going to be very clearly defined. So there is that paradox. And I guess the hope is there's a magic line somewhere in the middle where you have enough of both, but it's not clear that A, that line exists, and B, that we found it.
So Stephen, if you take that further forward then,
mm-hmm.
what are you saying that the next, potentially the next leap is actually tools that allow you to create the learning activity, which then uses these objects, creates a learning activity which in fact involves these learning objects, but also opportunities to collaborate, etc.?
The short answer is yes. The long answer is we need to rethink how we're approaching learning objects. Think of them not so much as self-contained units of learning, but rather self-contained units of information, standalone resources. And by resources, I mean not just little bits of content, some text or even some picture, but a resource could be anything. A resource could be an access to a discussion board. It could be a one-hour session with an online mentor. It could be a calendaring and scheduling service, whatever. And these resources are accessed in and used by what I am calling these days a learning environment. And the learning in learning objects occurs based on how these objects are used in this learning environment. So a learning object does not inherently contain learning. A learning object becomes a learning object only when it is used in some context to support learning. This is why my definition of learning objects is different from the one adopted by, say, IEEE. And so, in my mind, a learning object can be any resource whatsoever. And famously, I've used the example of a tissue paper as a learning object. And what makes it a learning object is it is used to support learning. So anything can be a learning object, but only those things that are actually used to support learning are learning objects. And so if you think of the history of an object acquires the property of becoming a learning object through use. I'll come back to that because you've anticipated like my last slide. Now, these enterprise systems, there's a huge barrier to these, and this huge barrier was really felt when Blackboard and WebCT dramatically increased their prices, and all the people who were using them suddenly realized, oh my, we're locked in. We can't move our content, and it's going to cost us $300,000. Enterprise systems are difficult for anything other than enterprises to run. If you're a one or two person operation, forget about an enterprise service or system. If you're a student working in your living room, forget about an enterprise service. You're not going to have that sort of thing. Java itself, my own experience with Java is storied and troubled. Java, as you know, if you've ever hit a web page with Java, if it operates on the client, that is to say in your browser, dramatically slows down your browser. Sometimes, very frequently, it doesn't work. There are various different standards. From a coding point of view, the code is long and cumbersome, and it doesn't always work. The delivery systems, in my experience, for example, what's the name of that thing? Tomcat. My experience is that they're unstable. They crash if the systems are underpowered. With Java, you need a much more powerful system. You need much better bandwidth in order to make this work. This is my experience. Your experience may vary. That's the law of the internet almost, right? Your knowledge may vary. But I don't see Java as ready for prime time. From the point of view of widespread adoption of things, it works very well in an enterprise setting. It does not work well in a distributed setting, ironically. Web services, everybody loves web services. Nobody's seen them. But, of course, that's not strictly true. People have seen examples of web services. I've seen examples of web services. I've even seen them work. But this remains future technology, in my view. there are alternative ways of doing the same thing. And, so, and you see this in some of the discussions. There's an alternative technology called REST, for example, Representational State Transfer, which does a lot of what web services does, but without the overhead. And for my money, good old HTTP request strings work really well for a lot of things. Web services have their place. There are specific things that they do, but in my mind, the idea of using them for everything is not sound. One of the major things with this model is its emphasis on content. And if you read my newsletter yesterday where I talked about the music industry and some of the obvious trends in the music industry, if there is a market for digital content now, and that itself is debatable, the bottom's about to fall out of it. There is not a market, a good, sustainable market for digital content. There won't be. Because digital content is A, incredibly easy to produce, and getting easier every day, and B, even easier to copy and distribute. The figure I use is two order of magnitude reduction in the price of content when it's digitized. That is to say, for example, if you have an online course that costs $100, it now costs $1. Or it now has a value of $1. If you have a piece of a music album that costs $14, you're looking at $0.14. And you might think, 14 cents, that's ridiculous. How can you sell an album for 14 cents? How can Microsoft offer a year-long subscription to all the music that you want for $30? I mean, in the music industry, we're almost to that point now. Of the bottom falling completely out of the content market. And in the music industry and in most other content industries, we have not yet hit the crunch point, because all of the problems that have occurred in that industry have occurred on the distribution end and not yet on the production end. But we're now, with systems like this, some free sound recording software and a cheap microphone, I'm now producing my own audio just on the fly in another city, in another country, and it's minimal effort. We are going to see, we are already beginning to see, a proliferation of all kinds of content with origins other than content publishers. So the whole world of blogs is, and I do a lot of work talking with people who are in the field of online journalism. I'm on the various online news mailing lists, and that journalists don't know what to make of blogs. And of course, they see blogs through their own lens. So they think blogs is some kind of publishing. It's just an alternative kind of publishing, but with lower quality. But blogs are seriously threatening journalism in the sense that they are producing a mass of coverage, equally good coverage of the same event. Encyclopedias. I've been talking throughout this tour about Wikipedia. Wikipedia is produced by its readers. They get nothing. They don't even get credit. It's produced anonymously. The software it runs on is open source. Access to Wikipedia is free. And yet, it has more articles than Encyclopedia Britannica. It's of equal or better quality, certainly more current, and it has more readers, more users, than Encyclopedia Britannica. Try to say that 8 times, 2 paragraphs. Encyclopedia Britannica is now obsolete, quite literally obsolete. Wikipedia has destroyed it. The corpse will linger on, but it's gone. Forget it.
Stephen?
Yes?
Can you tell me, what is a web service? And give me some examples of web services, please.
A web service is a mechanism whereby one software program can access the functionality or the output of a software program running on a remote computer. Part of the definition of web services also involves the definition and discovery of these web services. In other words, the location and the functionality of the remote service is discoverable on the fly by the current application of the web service. An example of a web service might be, for example, I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. A reservation system that is hosted by a restaurant or a hotel, and the application that would access that would be by a travel agency. So the user would access the travel agency, and they would work with the travel agency website, and they describe what kind of trip that they want. And then the software itself of the travel agency site would search and discover and find the appropriate web service offered by the restaurant or hotel and do a real-time inquiry, such as, are there any rooms available? Can I have a meal at 9 o'clock? And the web service would return this information to the travel agency program, which would then display it on the screen. And as an aside, that's a good example of how to use a web service. Because what's happening here is you're not simply accessing some data points or something like that. You're actually running a program on the other machine. Because the travel agency website now would also use a web service in order to make the booking, to schedule the dinner and whatever. And so you've got two separate software programs working together. How's that? Great. All right, and digital rights management issues? Do I even want to go there? All right. Let's just say there are digital rights management issues which the publishing industry labels under the heading of piracy, but which most of the internet labels under the heading of file sharing. And it's a cultural clash, a huge cultural clash. It's not a whole, it's not like we have suddenly have 60 million criminals out there. It's that we have an older culture and a new culture.
Aren't we applying the print industry, though, to digital resources?
I'm sorry?
Aren't we trying to apply the rules of the print industry to digital resources?
Yes.
Are they behaving completely different ways?
Yeah. That's exactly what's happening. Digital rights management implies that there is something static, something concrete that can be owned and moved about. The problem is, of course, in digital form, it doesn't have those properties of a physical object. So a large part of digital rights management is to enforce through software the application of physical properties to a non-physical resource. It won't work. But
excellent.
That's the next slide.
Stephen, just for the sake of flying the dissenting flag,
yep.
Keeping that going, I find that there's another problem with the consensus, and I've actually been using the word orthodoxy.
That works.
As a substitute.
That's probably better than consensus, because there is some shift beginning to happen out there.
Yeah. But another one of the problems that I think there is there, and I certainly experience it, is that there's way too much centre of gravity in, way too much US-centric centre of gravity in the ADL, IMS, IEEE alliance, if you like.
Well, Norm Friesen in his paper, Three Objections to Learning Objects, took it a step further. He says there's way too much U.S. military centric. I think that observation is sound. I think that when something like ADL throws $800 million at a concept, ADL basically defines what it is. I think that a lot of the organizations that are tooling up for e-learning are doing so with the U.S. military and government agencies as intended clients. I think that the point of view, the model of the marketplace that typifies American thinking is the model of the marketplace that's being transferred into the concept of learning learning objects and learning resources. So I think your observation is sound. It's just being Canadian, I'm very sensitive about how I phrase that. Well, that's on tape now. That's okay. I've said as much and worse to Americans, and they haven't barred me from the country yet, so... I'm sure I'm on file. There's another trend in the U.S., which is a... But I won't go there.
Judge United Council.
Yeah, exactly. What do you do? Same thing. Anyhow, analysis. I got three slides of analysis. Maybe four. I forget. But what's going wrong with the consensus, or if you will, the orthodoxy? Number one, the e-learning industry is misreading the marketplace. This is really important for your organization, I think. The orthodox view is that the client, the consumer, the customer is the institution. Is that what I say there? Yes. The enterprise level, the corporation. And you, especially you look in the world of corporate e-learning, all these companies are almost to the last one, designing e-learning for corporate clients, corporate learning systems, corporate HR support, so on and so forth. That is not the market. It looks really good because, you know, the enterprises and the corporations, that's the low-hanging fruit, right? You got one big contract and you're set for the next few years. The market is not the corporation. The vast majority of businesses, the vast majority of people do the vast majority of their learning outside that environment. They do it as individuals, as people. Even when we talk about universities and so on, or colleges as being the customers, there's this implicit assumption that learning is and will always be conducted at the college and university level. I think that's a tremendously fragile assumption. Incredibly fragile. Because if you ask yourself, what is keeping the university system in place today? There are two things. Number one, the monopoly on credentials. And number two, government funding. Take away either of those, much less both, and the university system moves immediately into a crisis, right? So, how likely is it that either of those things will go? Well, let's look at funding. How stable is long-term university funding? Well, we've learned in our own country and in the United States that it's very variable and it blows with the wind. And if a government with a certain frame of mind gets into office and realizes that people can and do get a university level education from non-university sources, they will come to the conclusion that what they are funding is not learning but a lifestyle. And their tolerance for that will be very brief. Credentials. Already, we've seen credentialing occurring outside the traditional educational context. In the world of computing, that's been around forever, right? You know, certified networking engineers, and Microsoft A+ certification, so on and so forth. We're seeing the rise of various testing services and so on. If the government at any point in time removes the university monopoly on credentials, we will see a proliferation of learning services suddenly being offered. At which point, the client for all of this e-learning stuff suddenly stops being the university. The university will be in survival mode at that point, and learning will be going directly to the learner. Long term, the client is the learner, not the institution. Long term, the people we should be asking when we do things like needs assessments and so on are not the professors or even teachers, with students, and even very young students.
Next slide, please.
I'm asleep.
Okay, I was expecting the zinger from the back.
Major, just going back to the other one, mm-hmm. Content versus services, you go. Can you elaborate on that one?
Oh, yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, you have to go back to
that. That's kind of hard. It only goes forward. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Sorry, I forgot all about that. But, I mean, there have been surveys done already in the e-learning industry. In the slide I was going to show this morning, I referred to one. But a lot of people in the industry already are saying that the dominant product in our field would be services and not content. The major reason for that is, as I suggested earlier, the bottom's falling out of the market for content. You know, MIT has open courseware. Who's going to sell all of this material now when you can get it for free? and you can do whatever you want with it. When I was in Utah, I talked with Luke Chu, who's busily setting up a program with volunteers to translate all of OCW into Chinese and Mandarin specifically, all run by volunteers. Who's going to compete on content? Who can produce content that you know, even if it's better content, that can compete with this free content? So the market falls out for content. What's left? Services and lifestyle. Frats will never go away, and there will always be a market for frats. But frats will go back, fraternities. I see puzzle looks. The fraternity is this particular U.S. institution whereby at a residential college or university, a bunch of like-minded, usually male, although there were also female versions, people get together, rent a house, live together in this house, and then as time goes by, construct an elaborate set of rituals surrounding the living in a common house. It's a social thing. The fraternity is the home of the famous toga party. The fraternity, you know, I mean, they use Greek letters to indicate the name of the fraternity. There's a whole, I don't want to say mysticism, but you know, there's a whole lifestyle around that. And, you know, it's something that has been in the U.S. and to a lesser degree in Canada historically attached to the university experience. That's what's being sold, right? The ability to live in a frat and make lifelong friends so that, you know, 30 years later, you meet somebody at a business meeting, you go, because these frats have chapters of all the different universities, and you do that, and they go, brother! And you forge this bond, you don't even know the person, because you know they share the same set of values and assumptions, because they're all like-minded. Well, they're not all like-minded, but that's the concept, right? And actually, a very powerful concept. It's a smart concept, and it's worth something. And so people will continue to sell and buy that, but in a very different sort of context. Counseling services, mentoring, one-on-one consultation, production of reports, just-in-time, as-needed reports, career services, so on and so forth. These are the sorts of things that constitute the future of the commercial marketplace in e-learning, rather than a block of text, a video of an instructor, a sound file, whatever. Those things have no monetary value. The huge social, cultural value, but no monetary value. Kind of like air.
Steve, can I just mention that we've got about 15 minutes left?
Yeah, about
20. So rather than have questions at the end, if you do want to ask questions through his presentation, do that, but we will have to, if I get this moving.
That's all right. I'll just do part two when I do the duplicate.
Yes.
So just stay. Of course, the people at the other sessions are so, where'd he come from? It's like he skipped the first five slides. The e-learning industry is badly misreading in my mind, the technology. Again, it's this whole enterprise computing thing, but nothing that I can think of that has had a widespread, substantial impact has been enterprise technology. And name one thing. You know, you sit down, you use your computer, what do you use that's enterprise computer over and above that which you're forced to use by the enterprise, and you wouldn't use if you had a choice? Email? Not enterprise. Web browsing, non-enterprise. Microsoft Word, non-enterprise. Not very good, but not enterprise. So on and so forth. The technologies that make the difference are not enterprise technologies, they're individual technologies. Well, we don't know what that is. That's Bill Gates with the Well, we'll let her answer. People say turn off your cell phone. It's just saying that. Turn off your whatever your conference phone. Large centralized systems indeed have what I would say is a dubious history. It's like those commercials that, you know, so and so uses SAP, right, or SAP. I'm waiting for the commercial and we'll never see it. So-and-so uses SAP and likes it. We'll never see that. Now, there are some exceptions to these centralized services. Google is a classic example. Centralized works extremely well. Amazon is another one. I think these may be blips. I think that these are successes that could and did occur under a very highly unusual set of circumstances. I think Google already knows this. And Google is working very hard at decentralizing, which is why, for example, they purchased Blogger, which is about as decentralized as you can get in a certain sense. Amazon, the minute something provides real competition to Amazon that's easily accessible at the desktop level, Amazon sales would drop in half. Amazon has a very powerful market right now, but they have the advantage of having been the market leader. They were able to play the network effect. When the network shifts, Amazon will be in trouble. Next slide.
Since my comments about quality, if I'm looking for something in educational research, I couldn't be bothered with Google because I get 12 pages.
Yeah.
I've got to search through. But if I go to Edna, I'll get it in about the first four or five.
Right. Can I say wait and see? First, and I will come back to that.
Okay.
All right. Because, I have a whole set of remarks on quality. I won't get to them all in this talk, but I'll touch on it. And I'll point a direction, and I'll probably linger on it more over the lunch hour. E-learning industry as a whole is misreading the business model. E-learning is still firmly entrenched in push media, broadcast media, packaging. They have a standard called content packaging, of all things. And push still works right now. We still have push media. We still have newspapers and publishers. We still have music producers and things like that. Push is not the long-term future. It is, and in some areas, it's not even a short-term future. The future of technology is what I style as pull. It's grassroots adoption. It's people choosing for themselves what, where, when, and how they're going to access something. Already some classic examples. ICQ, which was the forerunner to the various other instant messaging programs. You probably use Microsoft Messenger if you use anything. Huge success, zero advertising budget. It was all promoted by what's called viral marketing. Viral marketing is very large. And of course, it all works under the radar. It's viral. Blogs, classic example. Blogs didn't come out of any sort of broadcast model. Blogs emerged from the grassroots. People from themselves decided, I'm going to do a blog. RSS is probably, without a doubt, the most widely used XML standard that there is out there. There are millions of RSS feeds. No standards body. No single commonly accepted standard for all. In fact, there are many flavors and variety of RSS. In fact, we can't even agree on what RSS, the initials, stand for. No corporate support. Nothing. Yet it exists. It's huge. In fact, it's the most successful XML that there is. Now, there's a lesson in that. All the XML formats and standards being decided on by these standards bodies up to and including the placement of commas and something with no organizational structure whatsoever is the one that worked. Technology, business models. Most importantly, consumers are becoming producers. The e-learning industry has not grasped that concept at all. The idea that learning objects would be produced not by publishers, not by professors, but by students. And that will be, in say 10 years' time, students will be the dominant producer of learning objects. We're looking at 90-95% of them. Totally different business model. Next slide, please. The e-learning industry is misunderstanding convergence. All the talk, and even when I was working at something called Minimal, a learning and resource portal for the municipal sector in Alberta, the talk has been about vertical markets. closing a sector, right? Providing everything from the top of the sector all the way down. For example, Muni Mall, everything to do with municipal government, top to bottom. Sounded like a great idea. Didn't relate to any single person's experience because people don't live in sectors. People live horizontally across sectors. I am now a dirt player. I am now a technologist. I am now a user of Audacity. I am now a Civilization 3 fanatic. So convergence isn't vertical, it's horizontal. Convergence isn't by industry, it's by people. It completely redefines how we have to look at convergence and how we have to look at the delivery of services. The practical, the take home, we're talking about institutional portals and institutional services. No person is an institution. No person lives their life only in an institution. A university or college is just one segment of their life. And as soon as an application comes along, and it will, that treats their access to the university as one thing that they do and not the whole thing, things like institutional portals and so on will be rendered redundant. It's going to happen. So I say innovation should be based not on the sector, but on the person. The more personal the technology is, the more likely it is to succeed. It's exactly the opposite of what we're seeing in e-learning, with the exception of, interestingly, e-portfolios. Although e-portfolios, now I haven't looked at those closely, but that's an interesting idea because it's based on the person. But I see a push even within e-portfolios. It's the institutional version of the description of a person. So, you know, it's, you get the right idea, but then you put it out into this e-learning sector and they say, oh yeah, let's institutionalize it. That'll make it better. E-learning itself, as an industry, as a domain, is now in the process of merging with other sectors. NRC e-learning in New Brunswick, most of our inquiries for collaborations and new projects are coming from the health sector and some in, from the governmental, e-government sector, not to mention the business sector, of course. E-learning is part of e-health. E-learning is part of e-government. E-learning is part of e-commerce. E-learning is part of regular commerce. One of my cherished examples is the jar of strawberry jam. When you buy a jar of strawberry jam, strawberry jam will contain an RFID that will broadcast a weak wireless signal that will be picked up by your computer that will contain recipes and all the things that you need to know about strawberry jam. Nutritional information, how to use strawberry jam to make things, how they make strawberry jam for your kid, so on and so forth. That's e-learning. E-learning is part of making strawberry jam. Next slide, please. Federated search. Federated search, I won't go so far as to say it's evil, but it's close, because it's the wrong model. It's institution-based, centralized, slow, proprietary, elitist, and inefficient. And that's just part of it.
That's just the good things.
That's just the good things. Federated search, to make federated search, if you think about it, when somebody does a search on a federated search network, they do a search, that search propagates. That means if you are a member of the federation, you are supporting, in terms of computer processing power and memory, every single search that's done on that network. This is coming into your system. Whether or not you have anything to do with that search or not, even if you send out zero results, you're supporting this. So who can do that? Only big players. Federated search rules out anything under the institutional level. Rules out small to medium-sized enterprises. They have to get a broker. They have to sell their copyright, give away their materials and all their financial advantage in order to tag along with one of these big companies. Federated search restricts options for searches. That's why the commercial sector loves it. Because when Microsoft, with its Corvus image library, sees a person searching for an image of a lighthouse, they want that person only to be looking for options within Corvus. federated search makes that possible because the range of alternatives available in a federated search will be very limited. Federated search won't tap into all those free lighthouse pictures that are out there on the web, by definition, because the web isn't part of the federation. They didn't pay the dues. They didn't learn the secret mantra. They don't know the handshake. And it's inefficient and slow. Go out, try federated searches. Then try the same search on Google. We'll talk about quality in a minute, but just compare speed. Google, 10,000 results. Okay, maybe not so good, but federated search. And that's only with 20, 30 repositories. How's it going to scale? If you have anything more than 20, suppose you have 100, 200 repositories, a million repositories in a federated search. Think about it. Could you possibly do federated search in a million repositories? But you want a million content producers, don't you? Because how are we going to produce the content that we need? Next slide, please. The alternative to federated search is the harvest model. And here's where we tap into the success of Google. And I always wonder what to think of Edna and education.au, because you do harvest and you do federated search. It's kind of like EduSource, where we did not only harvest federated search, but also peer-to-peer. And there was a lot of confusion, a lot of conflicting agendas caused by that. The harvest idea is that each provider of a learning resource makes available some metadata describing the resource. And this metadata is harvested or retrieved. It's exactly the same thing Google does, except Google does it with web pages. And the aggregator brings this from multiple sources together and reorganizes it and reshapes it and then makes that available to a searcher. The result for the searcher, they access their search from a single point, so the search is very quick. But the information is coming from multiple sources, so the search is very varied. And the overhead for anyone participating in this system is very low. All they need to do is make their metadata available. They don't need to support processor-intensive functions like search on their own machine. All they need is a web server. Works beautifully. How do I know it works beautifully? RSS, which I already talked about, is a harvest model. RSS, as opposed to, say, a federated search of Microsoft, IBM, Cisco, and Sun, RSS is the model that succeeded, is succeeding now. Google succeeded. RSS succeeded. The federated search hasn't seen a widespread adoption. Harvest is already running in a way to the races. Open Archives Initiative is probably the most successful distribution of academic materials that exists right now. 3 million some odd resources from about 345 institutions being made available, harvested by aggregators such as a site called Oyster, O-A-I-S-T-E-R. Works beautifully. Searches are very quick. And nothing like that exists in learning objects, learning technology.
Stephen, we're going to have to wrap up, so yeah. I don't know whether you want to...
This is as good a place to stop as any. And if you guys are around for the lunch hour, I'll obviously review some of these slides, but I'll show more emphasis on the second part, because if you grant me a harvest over federated search and some of my assumptions, then you grant me most of what I need to make the case. And the case is that we need to rethink learning resources, but we also need to rethink the nature of metadata itself, who authors it, and where it's stored. And I'm saying no more metadata. It's because the centralized idea of metadata, this single sole producer, this one standard fits all, is the wrong model. It's simply the wrong model. I'll explain that in a lot more detail over the lunch break.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. And I'm sorry we have to exit.
It's no problem.
Rush this. So, I just want to say thanks very much for some of the messages. I think that you put forward this morning. Interestingly enough, I know Jerry and I've been talking about it's services, not content, that we should be focusing on. It was interesting that you actually, and I wasn't sure whether that we should actually put a copyright on that, Jerry. So that, no. Anyway, look.
You're looking on my website. I've got prior art.
So anyway, I think what you've done today, Stephen, is actually confirmed for me a lot of the direction that we've been going. I think we could actually have a good argument about what you're perhaps going on with here. And I'm just not sure where that option is going to be. At 11:30, for example, you'll be repeating sort of kind of this session. And maybe at 12:30, just before lunch, that's perhaps if people want to come back, we might set that up here. And Stephen, we might just go on from there. But I'm just conscious, sure, too, that you need to have a break also. So we will come back at 12:30 for those people who want to finish off what Stephen says. So Stephen, thanks very much. I really appreciate that. And thank you for attending today. I do have a present for Stephen, but it's going to be given after all of this. So I won't do that now.
I was expecting 3 or 4 presents.